The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Morris Williams, and it's my privilege to welcome you to another wonderful evening at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Let me ask everyone to please silence your phones or any other devices that you might have that might distract from others, and also remind you, no flash photography. I urge you to buy a copy of this wonderful book, The Men Who United the States, and join the author upstairs for book signing, which will follow his talk here this evening. It's a wonderful collection of knowledge, and he's a wonderful storyteller that will keep you entertained as you travel along the road. You have a wonderful piece of information in terms of what's contained in the program guide, but I would also note that he started a small newspaper in a small, tiny town in western Massachusetts, where he lives on a farm where he has bees and honey, which attract bears. The other significant thing that I would note that is in your program is how often do we have an author who has spent 3 months in jail on charges of spying? I do want to read just one quick comment that is included in his book that I wish it had been part of the conversation that took place in Washington over the last month. It cannot and should not be forgotten that the story of the United States of America is still a developing one, a continuing evolution, and that the Union becomes even stronger as a result of the pressures of steady change. After all, the very notion of change informs the preamble to the United States Constitution, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union. The union, it was recognized back in the late 18th century, has to be made even more perfect all the time. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving a wonderful Philadelphia welcome to Simon Winchester on his fifth return.
Thank you, Maurice, very much indeed, and thank you all for being here. I'm just going to say one thing initially, which is that although you've been told to turn off your cell phones, I'm actually allowed to keep mine on because I'm going to play something towards the end of this talk. So I just hope that nobody telephones me because then it'll be that embarrassing sort of Rudolph Giuliani moment when I... It does seem ironic, as Maurice was alluding to at the end, that I've written a book called The Men Who United the States, when, to judge from what's going on in Washington these days, America has never been less united. But I remain optimistic, and that's what this book is essentially all about. It's an optimistic tome about a country that I have been enraptured with ever since I came here first as a schoolboy, a 17-year-old, in 1962. And what I'm going to do initially is to tell you a little bit about the background of this book and how it came into being. I took a year off between high school and going up to Oxford in 63, and at the time had a girlfriend in Montreal, the kind of girlfriend-boyfriend that one does have when one's 17 and 16. And I took a job in... I vowed to go and see her, and took a job in London in a hospital cutting up dead bodies. £11 a week, I remember, and 4 shillings a body bonus. So I quickly amassed sufficient money to come across the Atlantic Ocean and saw the girlfriend, and that was all wonderful. And then decided, as I had many months at my disposal and a huge continent to go and have a look at, that I'd set out and travel across it. And so I hitchhiked, much to my parents' dismay, and found it was easy to get to Vancouver. and then turned left, essentially, and went down to have a look for the first time in my life, of course, at the United States. And I entered the country at the town of Blaine in Washington, and I remember vividly the first sign I saw was, "Welcome to the United States. It is illegal to hitchhike or pick up hitchhikers." And so I sat sort of forlornly under this sign, and within, I should think, 90 seconds, a young man in an open-topped British sports car, an MGB or a TR3 or something, picked me up and said, "Can I give you a ride to Seattle?" And that marked the rest of my 8 months that I spent in America, where people were unbelievably kind to me. I mean, to give you an example, maybe 6 weeks or 4 weeks later, I was in just south of San Francisco, and I had dinner with some people, and then they put me on to an on-ramp on 101 South. I couldn't get a lift. And finally, at about 5:30 in the morning, when I'm dog-tired, a policeman, San Mateo County Sheriff's Office, stopped and said, "Was I having problems?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, hop in, I'll give you a ride, and I'll show you some things." He took me to the police station. He introduced, well, quite, it started to get rather ominous. He introduced me to the desk sergeant, took my fingerprints for souvenir purposes, he said. I sort of expected to say, "Why don't I try on these nice steel bracelets?" But in fact, then took me home to his family. They made me breakfast. I had a shower. And then he drove me to a truck stop just south of San Francisco and ordered a driver to take me down to Santa Barbara. And the next day, this kind of thing continued. It was an amazing streak of good luck. I was picked up by a man who worked for NBC and was very well connected with Hollywood. He took me to a studio where John Frankenheimer was shooting 7 Days in May, and I got to meet Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas. And then he took me, I mean, it gets stranger and stranger, took me the next day to meet, to have coffee with Johnny Carson. And, but without belaboring lots of these nice incidents, it can all be summed up by the fact that when I entered the United States in Blaine in, when was it, sort of March, I took with me, carefully counted, 200 crisp American dollar bills. And when I left 7 or 8 months later from the town of Houlton in Maine to go back to Montreal to get my plane back to London, I had 182 of them left. So the entire journey had cost me $18 precisely. So I came back the following year, 63, now in a summer vacation, because I thought this was, you know, the cheapest country in the world. And this time it got even better, because I had a Union Jack on my rucksack. And this, if some of you will remember, 1963 was the year of the Profumo scandal. And so people would screech to a halt and ask whether I knew personally Christine Keeler or Mandy Rice Davies. Of course, I had not the foggiest idea. And then we had the great train robbery. So it was, well, how do you rob a train of £5 million? And all. So it was completely wonderful. And I got to meet on that trip President Kennedy at the opening of a lock on the St. Lawrence Seaway. And, of course, that made even more poignant his death in November, my first year at school. So altogether, I had this extraordinary impression of this country. I then went on to, I became a geologist. I went off to Uganda to be a geologist. Series of very unusual circumstances took me away from geology and into journalism. I went off to the northeast of England and became a journalist. Then I joined The Guardian, was sent to Northern Ireland for 3 years. And then, largely as a reward, I think, for having survived the beginning of the troubles, I was sent to Washington. So now I'm back in America, but now professionally. And generally speaking, in those years, which was 72 to 76, I was pretty well pinioned in Washington itself, because it was the years of the Watergate affair. So it was up to Sam Irvin's committee and all the rest of it, Rodino's committee. But occasionally they let me loose on the country, which was obviously enormous fun. And it sometimes sort of backfired. I remember when President Nixon resigned, which was on the 9th of August, 1974. I was in the White House for that, which is where I should have been. But when President Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, which was on the 8th of September, 1974, I was not in Washington. I was actually in Idaho covering Evel Knievel attempting to jump across the Snake River Canyon. And I remember my very lugubrious foreign editor, when I rang him up and said, he said, "What are you doing in Idaho?" I mean, the fellow didn't even have the good sense to kill himself, which would have put him on the front page of the paper. As it is, you know, a very expensive trip, and you're relegated to page 13 or something. But I did have one amazing trip. I came back again also as a journalist a little bit later after three or so years in India. And there was this one event which absolutely cemented my love affair for this country. This was at the time when English newspaper and magazine editors spent money like drunken sailors. I mean, you could get anything interesting, they'd send you off to do it. And on this occasion, some of you will remember a film called Paris, Texas. And I'd seen it, or was about to see it, and I wanted to see where exactly in Texas the town of Paris was. So I was looking it up in this marvelous book called The Official Atlas of the United States, one of the great legacies of the Nixon administration, I must say, looking for Paris, Texas, and I just happened to see in the adjoining index column that there was a great chunk of towns in America all called Paradise. And I thought, well, that's fascinating. There were 18 of them. And I thought, why were they called Paradise in the first place, and were they still Paradise? And I rang up one of these spending money like a drunken sailor editors, and I said, could I go and see them all? And he said, yeah, that'll be fine. So I took 6 or 8 weeks, I think, and made this long trek, partly by air, partly by car, starting with the first of them in geographical order, which was Paradise, Florida, which was a community outside Orlando, a retirement community, more a gateway to Paradise, I think, than Paradise itself. And then there was Paradise, Pennsylvania, which was on Route 43, just next to the town of Intercourse, which, of course, excites everybody, especially back in England. And there was Paradise, Arkansas, and Paradise, Montana. But the nicest of them all of them had been, by one form or another of modern American life, had been somewhat sort of downgraded from Paradise. But there was one which was absolutely blissful, and that was Paradise, Kansas, just near the town of Salina, so very close to the geographical center of the continental United States. And I went, as I always did, to the post office, and went to see the postmaster, who was a woman, or postmaster, whether male or female, of course, and said, I'm an English writer, and I'm doing this assignment of going to see all the towns called Paradise. She said, well, this is terrific. This is a community of about 280 people, and you must go and see, and probably they'll invite you to stay, the patriarchs of this village, who are John and Mary Angel. So I kid you not, I stayed with the angels of Paradise and Mary Angel. They had a cherry tree in their backyard, and she plucked off the cherries and baked them into a pie. And I think the moment that annealed for eternity my love affair with this country was eating cherry pie with the angels in Paradise. Anyway, I then went from there to China, I think. I went stayed in China for 12 or 13 years. And then when Hong Kong passed back from the hands of the British to the Chinese, I had one of those fork-in-the-road moments, whether I should go to London or go and live in New York. And I decided that I thought I would have a greater opportunity for freelance writing in New York, and moved there. And after a little while, paying taxes, now the old mantra of the revolution, no taxation without revolution, without representation, came to the fore in my mind. And I thought, if I'm going to pay the taxes, I ought at least to be able to vote here. So I set in motion the process, you know, quite long, and maybe some of you here have been through it, of becoming an American citizen. And I got the green card, and then you have to keep that blamelessly for 5 years. And then you start the process of actually applying for citizenship. And finally, I was called in the spring of 2011 to an office in Boston, where I was asked to do certain things, write a sentence in English and count to 10 or something, and then answer 10 questions about America, the first of which I'm happy to admit, well, I'm embarrassed to admit, but content to admit, I got spectacularly wrong, which is, Mr. Winchester, what is the American national anthem? And without thinking, I just said America the Beautiful, and there was this horrible pause, and he said, we all wish it were the national, but unfortunately it is the Star-Spangled Banner, so one down, nine to go. If you want to be a citizen, you better get the rest of them right. And luckily I did. And so in the end, I had this completely wonderful ceremony, which was staged on the after deck of the USS Constitution, which is this wonderful sailing vessel, the oldest commissioned floating warship in the world. We have HMS Victory, but that floats in cement in Portsmouth. But you have the oldest floating one, which does indeed go for a wander around Boston Harbor every year or so. And that was on Independence Day 2011, so highly symbolic in all sorts of ways. There were about 20 of us, not privileged people at all, just lucky people. The chap next to me was a refugee from Somalia. And the judge who swore us in, this remarkable lady, a federal judge, of course, called Marianne Bowler, I've since become very friendly with and indeed had dinner with her in Boston last Tuesday. She, among other things, is the judge who's now presiding over the Boston Marathon bombers case. So she was in the bedroom when the fellow woke up. And so she has a very interesting job. Well, I should say at this point, but this is when I decided that I wanted to write a book about America. But to put that in a tiny bit more context, I should say that I'd actually already written a book about America. I had written a book in 1974, I think, about Northern Ireland. And that it was called In Holy Terror, and it was about the origins of the Troubles. And it did reasonably well, which sort of instilled in me all the sort of hubris and arrogance of youth. And I thought, oh, well, I can write a book about America. And so I thought it'd be a neat idea to write a book which would come out in bicentennial year 1976. So I had this idea, which, I mean, in hindsight, looks incredibly naive, that the essence of America did not lie on the effete East Coast or the decadent West Coast, but the quiddity of the country was to be found in the Midwest. And so I thought I would spend 6 months driving through the Midwest. And I took my car and went to International Falls, Minnesota, and headed south down to Duluth and onto US or I-35, and went all the way down to Laredo in Texas, and then went back up to International Falls and back down to Laredo three or four times, and eventually came up with a book which was called American Heartbeat, which, in terms of the critical, I wouldn't call it a claim, but critical acceptance, was they were fairly polite to it. Customers, however, not so much. The royalty statement, which I got in 1977, and royalties is not quite the word to apply here, showed that it had sold exactly 12 copies. And about 3 years ago, William Least Heat Moon wrote to me to say that in researching his book, River Horse, he had bought another copy. So the total sales of this majestic piece of literature were 13 copies. So once I am a citizen and decide that I really want to sort of put the capstone on my American career, if you like, by writing a book about America, the one guiding principle at the very start was that it should be nothing like the book that I had written in 1976. But what could I write? And this was what occupied me for many weeks. And I put ideas to my publisher. When you say put an idea, it's not a question of you take him out to lunch and say, I'd like to do this. You actually write a sort of thought out 20 or 30 or 40 page proposal. So each idea is reasonably well thought out. So the first one was simply an expansion of what I've been talking about, my love affair, a sort of a paean to, a hymn to the idea of America. But quite reasonably, the publisher saw through that and said, no, that's simply not going to work. It's not going to interest people. Come up with a better and more solid idea. Well, I have this love affair with railways, and I thought it is technically possible to cross America from coast to coast on what are called Class 3 railways, which are these little mom-and-pop freight lines. And you can go from Eastport in Maine to a little town in Northern California. It would take many months. There'd be lots of permissions to get, but it would be possible to do. And so I wrote a very detailed account of how I planned to do it. And the editor said, no, that's going to be a book about railways, not a book about America, and it won't work. So I'm now getting sort of desperate. So I come up with an even more outlandish idea, which is there was a long-running series in Britain by a well-regarded author called Anthony Sampson called The Anatomy of Britain, and I thought I'd write The Anatomy of America, but I do so by basing it on Grey's Anatomy, not the television program, but the big fat medical book. So I got an 1858 copy of it and looked at the way that Mr. Grey or Dr. Grey had organized it, and I thought I could do the same thing for America, so that the brain would be the universities and the nervous system would be the telecommunications and the arteries would be the highways and the skeleton would be the concrete and the ironworks. And my editor just shook his head in disbelief. He said, this is simply so contrived, you'd be laughed out of court. Forget it. So I'm really stumped now. And then I suddenly thought, looking at the name of the country that I wanted to write about, I fixated suddenly on the word united. How could this country have managed for so long, despite the unpleasantness, of course, of the 1860s, to remain pretty steadfastly united for its entire history? Because no other large nation in the world or large aggregation of peoples can lay claim to being successfully united. I mean, dear old Canada up north, I mean, I'm going to have to go on this book tour to Canada, so I'm not quite sure how I'm going to explain that, but it's big, same sort of size as this country, or bigger, but it's a reality that there is a great big grumpy francophone block in the middle of it, Quebec, and that it's always threatening to break the country into three. Russia, manifestly not united. You've only got to look at what Mother Russia has turned into since the collapse of communism, all these various states and statelets all grumpily warring at each other. Europe, where I come from, I mean, we've done our best after centuries of warfare within Europe to unite Europe, but we're clearly not particularly. I mean, we in Britain, we don't use the euro. Switzerland's not a member. Try and plug in your electric razor in Stockholm, you'll need a different plug than the one you'll need in Madrid. They're all jabbering away in foreign languages at each other. It is clearly not united. And yet America, despite being made up of all manner of people, of colours and religious backgrounds and ethnic heritage and ideas and outlooks, has managed to hang together. Well, how has this been achieved? I mean, it's fairly easy for a country where everyone's more or less the same, like Norway. Everyone's Norwegian, everyone sort of thinks more or less the same way. Easy to be united. Japan, where my wife's from, much the same. Japan has never really been thoroughly divided. But America's so polyglot, such a mongrel mixture, such a weird amalgam, and yet it has managed to. Well, possibly you could say that a language, a common language has helped, a common belief in democracy and human rights and shared values has helped. But these are sort of abstract things that didn't really interest me in quite the way that deliberate agencies of man, sort of concrete ideas, physical links, they seem to be the things that were uniquely American in their scale and strength. So I started making a list of people that I thought had contributed to the unification of this country, beginning, of course, with people that are tremendously important over here, and that's Lewis and Clark. They were the first to delineate the extent of this country. And then I came up with a bunch of other people, most or many of them well-known, but most of them actually not well-known at all, obscure, vanished into history. And my wife came into the study one day and said, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm making a list of these people who I think were involved in knitting this country together. And she said, oh, you're making a list of the men who united the states. And I stopped and I said, you are so wonderful. And see why I married you, because you have given me the title. And I went instantly to Amazon.com and to ABE Books and Alibris and all the various university and public libraries and looked up, and no one has ever used this title. It's a magically good title. The book may be dreadful, but the title is very good. And the thing is that once you've got a title, it really focuses your idea. So I now knew what I was going to do. And I should say, before I get any objections and to forestall any anticipated criticisms, this is a book that largely involves men. I mean, people have said to me, why didn't I write about Harriet Beecher Stowe? This isn't so much a book about ideas as the physical links. There's only really one woman that plays a role in this book, and that is Sacagawea in the Lewis and Clark expedition. So I'm not going to apologize, but I hope the ladies here will accept that this is a reality of this story. So I assemble the list, but then there's the question of how you organize it. And I've taught a little bit of creative nonfiction writing at the University of Chicago and the University of California. And it's always struck me that there are three important things when you come to write a nonfiction book. Probably the same could be said of fiction, but I'm not clever enough to do that, I've always believed. The first thing is the idea. The idea is king. That is absolutely central. The quality of the writing is very important too. There's no doubt about that. But it's not the second most important thing. The second most important thing in the writing of a readable book is the structure. You can write lyrically about a wonderful idea, but get the structure awry, and you'll send people to sleep. So I had to come up with a structure for this book, and all I've got now is an idea. How do you achieve and sustain unity in this country? And I've got the names of the people who, in my view, achieved this. But how do you organize them? Well, you could put them in an alphabetical order. But, I mean, that would just read like the Encyclopedia Britannica. It would be so dull. You could organize them chronologically, which has a sort of better narrative thrust. But looking at it, it similarly would read much like a catalog or an encyclopedia. And then one day, I was writing a letter to a friend of mine in Shanghai. I mentioned that I lived in China for a long time. And we were talking in our correspondence about the propensity in most countries east of India to have at the base of most of their philosophical structures of their society a number of four or five, what they call in China, classical elements. There are usually about four in India, but once you get east of the Mekong and you start moving into China and Vietnam, Japan, Korea, it usually settles down to five classical elements. And there's some changes, but mostly they're the five that are regarded centrally in China. And those five are wood, earth, water, fire, and metal. And it's the interaction between these five things which lies at the heart of much of particularly Chinese civilization. And it suddenly occurred to me, I've got the names and I've got this idea of these classical elements in front of me, that it would be possible, and it wouldn't be too artificial, in fact, to corral these names and these people into these five categories. And moreover, I thought vaguely that the five categories would actually work in a chronological order as well. So let me just try and explain that a bit further. When Lewis and Clark were sent off, they were sent off, I'm sure you know the story, that Jefferson was sitting in Monticello reading a book that had been sent to him from London by a man called Alexander Mackenzie, who had crossed the country in Canada and had incised his name on a rock off a place called Bella Coola in British Columbia. He'd written a book about having done this, printed in London, copy ultimately sent to Monticello. Jefferson read it and was outraged that some Canadian had been the first one to cross the North American continent. He was outraged. He said to Meriwether Lewis, who was sitting beside him, "You jolly well go and find out if you can cross. You must go and see the Pacific. Forget this Canadian chap. We'll discover our own country for ourselves. Pick up, you know, a group of people and a friend of yours, and off you go." Now, he said this on the western terrace overlooking the Blue Ridge Mountains at Monticello. Jefferson was obsessed with trees. If you go to Monticello today, you can still see, or you could until 5 or 6 years ago, trees that he had actually planted himself that are 200 and odd years old. The long alleys of orange trees and apple trees and oaks and catalpas and ginkgos, all planted by him. He loved trees. He sent these men off across the Blue Ridge Mountains, mountains that he had never crossed in his life before, despite having been to Paris and Europe. He'd never gone west of the Skyline Drive. The men who went, he sent off spent, before they got to St. Charles, Missouri, where the expedition really took off, they went through 800 miles of almost virgin American forest. They went in wooden canoes, mostly wooden canoes. They built wooden palisades for themselves. They built campfires out of woods. Wood was a dominant feature of the life of all early American explorers. So I thought, well, I can certainly corral all of these people under the general rubric of wood. What about Earth? Well, once the size of the American continent had been delineated, once we knew where the Rocky Mountains were, once, thanks to Sacagawea and the Lewis and Clark expedition, we knew where the Sierras were, we knew where the Pacific Ocean was, where the rivers drained into it. Once all that had been known, now we needed to know what America was made of. And we sent out surveyors, geologists, one of whom, hugely important here in Philadelphia, of course, and I should bring up a sort of moment of personal embarrassment here. I had written a book in, I think, 2001 called The Map That Changed the World, which was about a man called William Smith, who was the father of modern geology, and over 15 years of heroic exploration in Britain, came up in 1815 with the first ever geological map of anywhere. So that was the map that changed the world. Doing research for this book, I found out that, in fact, the earliest geological map of anywhere was not William Smith's, but it was actually drawn here by a man called William McClure, who was head of the American Philosophical Society, and it was published 8 years earlier. So my publisher in London has said that, ever aware of the sort of commercial prospects of this, saying, well, you may be wrong, but maybe we can relaunch your book as the second map that changed the world and therefore make a virtue out of this. Anyway, McClure's map is stunningly beautiful to look at. It's entirely wrong, entirely inaccurate. But it did trigger an interest in geology. And so I write about him and his expedition down to a place called New Harmony in Indiana, where geology's birthplace was. And then there were the four great surveys which Lincoln ordered in the 1860s and 1870s, led one of them in one case by a man who I'll tell you a bit about later. So insofar also as the early geologists discovered things in the West, you know, diamonds, coal, or farmland and so forth, which lured out the pioneers, the Mormon Trail, the Oregon Trail, the Santa Fe Trail, so geologists and Earth were very important. So we've got wood, we've now got Earth, and those two seem to work quite well. Water. Well, the first settlers, when they went into the interiors of this country, paddled up the rivers, the Susquehanna, the Rappahannock, the Hudson, the Potomac. And usually after 60 or 70 or 80 miles, they were stopped by waterfalls and rapids, the what was called the fall line, where the Appalachian Mountains end and the coastal plain begins. And at the fall line, where they stopped because of these waterfalls, first of all, they built settlements, which turned into Richmond and Fredericksburg and Washington, D.C. and Albany. But then once they began trading from these settlements, they realized that to get over the rapids, they had to build crude canals, and so they learned how to do that. And then canal building became a very important part of early American engineering, and you get canals built which completely changed the economic geography of the country. You've got the Middlesex Canal up in New Hampshire and eastern Massachusetts, which essentially made Boston a major commercial port. The most important canal, I think, in all of America was the Erie Canal, built between Buffalo and Albany, and which all English schoolchildren, I remember as a 12-year-old having to write essays on discuss the significance of the Hudson-Mohawk Gap, which I suggest that most American schoolchildren these days have no idea. But we knew American geography very well when we were little. And then in Chicago, linking Chicago to the Mississippi, the Illinois and Michigan Canal, and then the horribly named Chicago Sanitary Canal, which was indeed first built to allow Chicago's human waste, if I can put it like that, no longer to be dumped into the lake, but sent over to the West when people didn't so much care about it. But great ships could come along that canal as well. So that linked the Great Lakes to the Mississippi. And then, of course, the canalization and the taming, if it can ever be tamed, of the Mississippi River itself. So all of that could be put into, and all of the people involved in that could be put into the chapter of how American story was told through water. And then fire, well, going across America or up and down America by river was all fine and dandy, but very slow. And America now, in the middle of the 19th century, was getting so energetic and so commercially eager, it wanted to get across the country rapidly. And by now you've got James Watt's steam engine already invented, so let's employ that to create devices of all sorts, which have at their core a source of heat, fire, which provides the motive power for railway engines or later trucks and then motor cars and then aeroplanes and things like that. So this chapter can talk about the early building of railways and the interstate highway system's origins, the first ever aeroplane traffic across this country, and so on and so forth. So that worked quite neatly. And as you can see, each one follows the other chronologically, as indeed does the fifth and final, which is metal, which is the conducting wire of the telegraph, and then the distribution of electricity, and then the invention of radio and television, and, of course, finally, the Internet. So it took a couple of days to organize my list into these five categories, but it seemed to work. And so I went and had lunch with my editor and said, did he think that would work? Because one is a little nervous. And he said, I'm nervous too, because some readers may think that looking at America through the prism of Chinese classical philosophy might be something that a lot of Americans would find troubling. Well, all I can say, and I hope I don't sound too glib in saying so, is that this is early days. The reviews thus far have been very kind of this book. I know the New York Times review is due on the 10th of November, so I'm crossing my fingers for that. But I think thus far, I can say that I think I've gotten away with it and that the structure has been generally accepted. So with that in mind, what I thought I'd do is to... This is a great sort of plum pudding of a book with a lot of things in it, but I'd take from it two or three things that I found unusual when I was doing the research and tell you a little about them. These were all things that I didn't know about, and I'm interested to know how many of you know about... I'm going to talk about one place and then a couple of things. The first place... I've asked the question of all the audiences that I've spoken to thus far, which has been half a dozen. How many of you know of or have been to the town of East Liverpool, Ohio? Someone at the back? Another person? Three. That is sort of par for the course. The Boston Athenaeum and you, exactly the same. New York, nobody. So East Liverpool, Ohio is, in my view... one of the most important things in the story of the making of this country. It's a forlorn, broken-down little town on the west bank of the Ohio River, at the point where Ohio and Pennsylvania and a little sliver of West Virginia all join. You've almost certainly all got in your houses things that were made in East Liverpool, because for many years, it was the crockery capital of America, and most plates and cups and saucers and coffee pots were made in what used to be some 400 kilns in this town. Well, now there are, I think, two kilns left. If pottery rusted, this would be a classic rust belt city, because it's all decayed industrial plants. It's a very sad place. But if you drive out of East Liverpool towards the river and therefore towards Pennsylvania, you will pass on Route 39 on the south side a little obelisk. It's a little taller than I am. It has graffiti on it. There's litter. There are a couple of historical marker signs which similarly have got graffiti on. It's an utterly unregarded place. No one visits it. Most of the people in East Liverpool itself don't know what it is. It is a hugely, hugely important thing. And it goes back to an act that was passed in 1785 in this country, which I think is one of the most profoundly important and revolutionary pieces of legislation ever. It was passed, or at least stewarded through the Congress by Jefferson, whose idea it was. It was called the Land Ordinance of 1785, and it allowed Americans uniquely to own their own land west of the Ohio River, the land that was currently being explored. The traditional view up to that point was that, coming from England, the old Anglo-Saxon tradition was that the king owned land, the church owned land, the aristocracy owned land, but the people could merely be tenants. But Jefferson's view was that in this new country, everyone should be allowed to own land. And I'm not here getting into the question of who owned the land by rights before that, as that gets into a whole sort of all property is theft kind of argument. And we're just going to establish that as a reality. And believe you me, I do write extensively in this book about Native Americans. But accepting that, Jefferson said this land must be owned. Because once a man can own land, he can build on it, he can farm at it, he can sell it. And we, the government, we can levy taxes on it so we can get money to administer the nation. Everyone, it seemed, would win from such a situation. But in order to sell land, it's first of all got to be surveyed. You've got to have an organizing principle for how this land is mapped. And so the system of townships and ranges and sections that you'll all know too well, and I'm sure you all do it. You're sitting in an aeroplane going to California, and you look out of the window and you're bored, and you see these north-south lines going past, and you know they're exactly a mile apart, and you count them, how fast they're going under the wing, and you work out how fast the plane is going and whether you're going to be late into San Francisco or Los Angeles. I assume you all do that. I certainly do, anyway. Well, these straight lines, north and south, have to have a point of origination, the point where the first ever line drawn north-south and the first base meridian going east-west were drawn. And they were drawn by a man called Thomas Hutchins, who was the first ever, and indeed only ever, geographer of the United States. And the point of beginning, as it's called, is in East Liverpool, Ohio. And that obelisk marks the place where all Western America was measured from. Hugely important. And the fact that it is a disregarded, overlooked place strikes me as monstrous. I think there should be a huge parking lot. There should be an interpretation center. Every school child in the northeast of America should regard this as a place that he should go to. So that's one thing I wanted to mention that I think is important. Another, this relates to a gentleman who is generally, I think, forgotten. Lincoln, who you might think had other things on his mind in the 1860s, nonetheless established the idea that, as I mentioned earlier, all of America should be comprehensively surveyed by geologists to find out what the country is made of in detail. And so four men essentially are remembered for playing the part in leading the four great surveys. There was a man called Wheeler, who's a bit dull, and he surveyed a slightly dull corner of the country, the Dakotas, Nebraska, eastern Wyoming, Colorado. But then there are the others. There's Hayden, who discovered and mapped Yellowstone. There's John Wesley Powell, who I dare say most of you will know, who, despite only having one arm, managed to go all the way down and survey and map the Grand Canyon. And parenthetically, I would have thought that both Hayden and Powell would be spinning in their graves if they knew that the national parks that they essentially originated had been closed because of this rather trivial dispute in Washington. But the fourth of their number, the fourth of these great surveyors, was a man called Clarence King. And Clarence King, oh yes, well, maybe you know his story, and it is an extraordinary one. Clarence King was from a good Newport, Rhode Island, WASP family. He mingled with the great and the good. He was a great friend of Henry Adams. He was a great friend of John Hay, who went on to be Secretary of State. He was part of the American WASP establishment. He went to Yale. I think he did his PhD in Harvard. He was a geologist and a consummately brilliant geologist. And he was appointed at the age of only 27 to lead what was called the 40th Parallel Survey, where he went off to Sacramento and was told survey all the land 1,000 miles to Cheyenne and 100 miles north and south of that line. Well, it took him 7 years to do it, and the reports are impeccable, comprehensive. They cost, if you buy them today in an antiquarian bookstore, they'll cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars. Beautiful, beautiful work. And as a consequence of doing this work so brilliantly, he was appointed to be the first ever director of the newly formed U.S. Geological Survey, a body which exists today, the USGS, which produces all the maps of this country. His successor, the number two, was John Wesley Powell, but he was the first. Now, the thing to say about Clarence King has actually, which interests me, has nothing to do with geology at all, but has to do with his personal predilections. I hope no one will find this offensive, but he did not have any interest at all. He was a very sexually energetic man, but he had no interest in white women. He found them tedious in the extreme. He loved Native American women, and he particularly loved black women. There came this day in New York in the late 1870s, I think it was, when he was walking in Riverside Park, and he saw coming towards him a black lady who, it was a coup de foudre. He knew this was the woman of his dreams. What he should have done, I think in retrospect, was to have gone up to her and said, "Good evening, madam. My name is Clarence King. I'm the director of the United States Geological Survey. Could I take you to dinner?" But he didn't. Instead, and miscegenation was the problem of the time, social ostracism, he went up to her and said, "Good evening, madam," thinking incredibly quickly, but perhaps a little too quickly on his feet, "Good evening, madam. My name is James Todd." Where he got that name from, I have no idea. "My name is James Todd, and although I may look white, I am in fact black. And I am a porter with the Pullman Company. Will you have dinner with me?" And she agreed. They had dinner. They fell in love. They married. They had five children. He, from that moment on, for the remaining 20 years of his life, lived two entirely separate lives, never telling the one about the other. And so a typical day or month in Clarence King's life, or in James Todd's life, is that he would say to Ada Copeland, she was now Ada Todd, and the five children, two of whom were somewhat unaccountably as white as the driven snow, said, "Well, my dear, I've got to go off on the 20th Century Limited or the California Zephyr. I'll be back in 2 weeks." And he would leave the house and he would walk across the newly constructed Brooklyn Bridge to the offices of the Geological Survey in New York and say, "Well, that was a pretty tricky field expedition. I'll be doing my notes for the next 2 weeks." And he would sit down and attend to his notes and then say goodbye to everybody. Must go off on another field trip, walk back across the Brooklyn Bridge to Queens, assume the identity of James Todd, greet his children, give his wife the tips that he had got on the railway. And so this would go on for 20 years. It took an extraordinary toll on him. Financially, for a start, he had to borrow lots of money from John Hay, who at the time was Secretary of State. He went completely potty on one occasion, and basically hit someone very hard outside the lion cage of the Central Park Zoo and had to be taken off to an asylum. He was a very sad man, but then became ill and was taken off to Albuquerque in New Mexico. He had TB to convalesce, but in fact he didn't recover. And he decided then, on his deathbed, that he would confess to his doctor what had happened. And he said, would he, the doctor, kindly write to Mrs. James Todd in Queens and tell her that her name was, in fact, Mrs. King, and that her husband was not the slightly black man she'd thought him to be, but was, in fact, white Newport aristocracy, which was the reason that two of the children were white. And he was terribly sorry and then died. And the doctor, I thought it was touching, it sort of plays into the central idea of the book, I suppose, is that, and I've seen the death certificate, which discusses race of deceased, and the doctor had scored out the words white and black, and in handwriting had simply written the word American. Two more little things. I've been fascinated, and I'm looking at the clock, so I don't want to go on too long. Plus, I want to play you this little thing. I'm fascinated with the distribution of electricity as one of the unifying features. You all, I'm sure, know that first electric power was generated by DC, direct current, by Thomas Edison. First power station was in Lower Manhattan. But the thing about DC is that the further you are away from the power station, the current diminishes, the lights dim. So then Nikola Tesla, great forgotten hero, invented AC. George Westinghouse bought the patent. There was this so-called war of the currents, which eventually was won by Westinghouse, and we all have AC today. However, that was in the 1930s. It was the cities had AC electricity. The farms did not, because people like Samuel Insull, a British man, I'm ashamed to say, or used to be when I was a Brit, I'm now an American, he didn't countenance the idea of, he said it was totally uneconomical to string wires to the farms, and that the 800,000 farms in America so far as he was concerned, continue to have the entirely manual labor. FDR, of course, saw this as monstrous, and one of his many proposals was that we should have that all farms should be electrified and set up to do so, the REA, the Rural Electrification Administration. And the stories, I'll just read you a tiny bit of this book about, as you probably know, farmers had to pay $5 to join a co-op, which would buy the electricity. And then they would get, well, finally it was all done. The moment usually came at dusk. I wanted to be at my parents' house when the electricity came, wrote one REA customer. It was in 1940. We'd all go round flipping the switch to make sure it hadn't come on yet. And when they finally did come on, the lights just barely glowed. And I remember my mother smiling when they came on full. The tears started to run down her cheeks. The moment is still recalled by old-timers in some of the more distant parts of the country. The night the lights came on was as significant a moment as a birthday, often more so. The REA's celebratory volume, published half a century later, is filled with affecting reminiscences, such as this one from Kentucky. We'd heard the government was going to lend us money to get lights, but we didn't believe it until we saw the men putting up the poles. Every day they came closer and we realised it was really going to happen. So Dad went ahead and we had the house wired. It was almost 2 months later before they finished the job and turned on the power. I'll never forget the day. It was late on a November afternoon, just before dark. All we had was wires hanging down from the ceiling in every room with bare bulbs on the end. Dad turned on the one in the kitchen first, and he just stood there holding the pull chain. And he said to me, "Carl, come here and hang on to this so that I can turn on the light in the sitting room." I knew he didn't have to do that, and I told him to stop holding the chain and that it would stay on. So he finally let go, and then he looked kind of foolish. But the foolishness, I think, belongs in another quarter, and that's that the first ever electrification of any farm in America took place in 1935, under the REA's scheme, in far western Ohio, a town called Miami, Ohio. And that is in the 8th Congressional District of Ohio, a constituency which today is represented in the U.S. Congress by no less a figure than John Boehner. So John Boehner, the archetype foe of big government, presides over a tract of territory which, more than almost anywhere else in the country, benefited mightily from the biggest big government America's ever known. The final thing I want to talk about is radio. I've always thought radio is one of the great cultural unifiers of this country, and talk later perhaps about how cable television and the internet is doing precisely the opposite. But the image of the radio set, walnut-covered in the living room with the family gathered around it, mother, father, children, dogs, cats, all listening to maybe the NBC Symphony Orchestra broadcasting from New York or a comedy program coming in from Los Angeles, seems to be emblematic both of a unified country and a unified family. But that all required that the radio be able to broadcast the human voice. If you remember when the radio was invented by Marconi, it was entirely devoted to sending Morse code. And we have the image, I think most of you will remember, of Marconi, 1902, sitting on top of Signal Hill in Newfoundland with a kite above his head, listening through the static of the atmosphere, hoping that he would hear from 2,000 miles away in Cornwall his men who were tapping endlessly the letter S. Did-did-it, 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 did-did-it. Heard nothing for hours, and then this incredible moment, sort of 2 a.m, huge storm howling, hearing faintly through his earphones, did it, and realised that radio could span the Atlantic Ocean, that the radio really had an amazing future in uniting peoples. But no national conversation could really be undertaken in Morse code. It's hardly an intimate way of communicating. What was needed was for the human voice to be transmitted. And that was all down to a man generally forgotten these days, a man called Reginald Fessenden, who was a Canadian, actually, and he worked for the National Weather Bureau in America. And he came up with the idea, the initials will be familiar to you now, AM and FM, amplitude modulation, frequency modulation, which allows basically, instead of you attaching a Morse tapper to a radio transmitter, you can attach a microphone like this. And anything that can be picked up by this microphone can, so far as Fessenden was concerned, could be transmitted. So he set up two aerials, enormous aerials, one at a place called Brant Rock in Massachusetts, very near where Plymouth Rock was, ironically, the other over in a place called Macrahanish in Argyll in Scotland, to do some test transmissions. And once those had been proved to work, then he decided to try it out on the public. And what he did was he sent a message by Morse code, which was the only thing radio operators knew, alerting them to listen out on Christmas Eve 1906, 1 minute to midnight, to all the ships of the United Fruit Company that were lumbering up the Western Atlantic, bringing bananas from places like Tegucigalpa in Honduras to the great ports of the East Coast, Savannah, Charleston, Boston, New York, Baltimore, saying, listen out for a different kind of signal. And so these men, and it was classically, and I'm not exaggerating this, a dark and stormy night. There was a huge snowstorm, a blizzard off Cape Cod. These ships lumbering through the waves, bitter cold. But the radio operators went down to their radio shacks and they tuned in to the transmission and they heard all the static and the Morse from other ships at sea. And then all of a sudden, instead of Morse, they heard this. It was Emmy Leisner singing Ombra Mai Fu, which has nothing, of course, to do with America. It's all about a king of Persia and the shade of a tree. Fessenden came on the radio after that was over and recited the Lord's Prayer and then a Happy Christmas to you all. And with that, because shortly thereafter, a little radio station opened in Pasadena above a musical instrument store, which still exists to the day. Then in Madison, Wisconsin, an aerial was built in a cornfield to start WHA, which was the first ever radio station in the country. But with this broadcast of Emmy Leisner singing that wonderful aria, the national unifying radio conversation began. Thank you very much indeed. Yes.
You could take about three or four.
Right? Yes, I'm afraid, as I've been told, and as I suspected, I do tend to rabbit on rather a lot, so I'm apologizing, but I think maybe three or four questions, and if anyone has got any, I'd be delighted to. The gentleman, Morris.
Whatever happened to Mrs. Todd?
Well, it's unfortunately, this being America, there were a lot of lawsuits that there was a considerable amount of money in the long term from the king's estate, despite him owing so much. And it went on till the 1930s. People were arguing, the children were arguing. She lived on for quite a number of years, became somewhat stout. And but it's not an entirely happy story. But it's in the book.
Do you mention the industrious at all, like Rockefeller or Vanderbilt, throughout your book, and how they contributed to building?
The question is whether I look at the great people like the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers only passingly, because they didn't have, in my view, the ideas that that they capitalized on quite literally. They were beneficiaries of earlier ideas. Vanderbilt, of course, very much the beneficiary of things like Theodore Judah's discoveries, which allowed the Transcontinental Railway to start. So I try and go back to the origins. So I don't look at Carl Icahn and TWA. I look at Calbraith Rogers and the first ever flight sponsored by the most repulsive soft drink that has ever been made, Vin Fizz, which was a pink substance which someone said best drunk cold or best not at all, which was Philip Armour of the Armour Meatpacking Company's firm intention to use every imaginable part of the cow. And there was a pink gelatinous substance which comes from some unmentionable part of the cow, and he thought, add a little bit of sugar and some soda water. Well, they couldn't sell it, but they thought it would be a nifty idea to use it to sponsor this cigar-chomping, half-deaf man called Calbraith Rogers, who bought a biplane from the Wright brothers and managed to fly the first one to do so across this country. So no one drank Vin Fizz again, but his legacy remains in the book.
The book is dedicated to your mother-in-law. Would you comment on that, please?
Well, thank you for bringing it up. What happened basically is my wife, as I mentioned, is Japanese, and her mother, Akiko Sato, her husband, Makoto Sato, on the 22nd of February last year, I hope you won't mind me being a bit personal here, but you did ask the question, our beloved dog died or had to be put down. So we were very, very sad, but were cheered up by the thought that the next day, the 23rd of February, would be my mother-in-law's 80th birthday. So we had arranged, because she's a very, very conservative Japanese lady, that we would take her to a restaurant called Hakubai, which is in the ground floor of the Kitano Hotel at Park Avenue and 38th Street in New York, and that we'd take a room upstairs where people could leave their coats and there would be the birthday cake and things like that. And so my wife and I first went to their apartment to have tea with them, and I happened to mention that I was writing this book and that I'd decided finally on this classical Eastern structure of wood, earth, water, fire, and metal. And Mrs. Sato went into her bedroom and came back a few minutes later with, on a piece of white card, the Chinese characters for those five elements, the English words and the Japanese words for those five things, and gave it to me. And I just thought it was a terribly nice thing to have done. So I put it in my pocket, and my wife and I then walked to the Kitano Hotel, found the room, arranged that the cake would be delivered on time, the champagne was on ice and all the rest of that stuff. So everyone assembled. There were about 14 of us for a very classically Japanese dinner, which everyone enjoyed mightily. And so we went upstairs, and the 80 candles had indeed been lit and were duly blown out in stages, I think. And then we had a couple of bottles of 1999 Dom Perignon, which went down very nicely. And then the children there had assembled a video montage of all the highlights of Mrs. Sato's life thus far. And then her English wasn't frightfully good, so she had been practicing walking around Central Park all day with a friend of hers and made the speech, and it was word perfect. And then she went round the room, hugging everyone in the room and thanking them for coming, sat on the sofa and dropped dead. Exactly. When you think about it, the best of all possible ways to go, surrounded by friends and family. But that piece of card was the last thing she ever wrote in her life. And so I thought it was reasonable to enclose this in the dedication. So the book is dedicated to her memory. Anyway, thank you very much for asking the question. And I think probably that ought to be, and probably appropriately is, the last question. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.